And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So our brilliant and beautiful ally, Deborah Felmuth, will be joining us shortly. Our theme is Syria, Remember Me, Grief and Beauty. Deborah is the Venusian guide to intimacy with the beauty of the Middle East and author of the forthcoming book, Syria, Remember Me, and she will be joining us in a few moments, minutes. But first, let's see. We are here to heal on micro and macro levels. As many of you know, I will be co-emceeing the spoken word stage at Symbiosis Gathering. That's symbiosisgathering.com, September 17th through 20th in Oakdale, California. And my wonderful, wonderful co-MC, Amakayla Gaston, who for 19 years sings the Oya Day intro to this show. So beautiful and wonderful. Her home in Oakland was burgled last week, and everything was taken. Drums, photographs, furniture, cups, saucers, toothpaste, apparently, everything. Not only computers, but backup discs for all of her incredibly great work around the world. Ami is one of the most radiant and charismatic and powerful black women, chantresses, and invokers of good magic in the world that I know of. So we want to propose a little radio magic with the Orishas, with whom she is so kinned. We know that terrible, profound word that sounds like what it is, Anomi. Anomi. It means Anomi. So many in the world right now are experiencing this. So in micro loss, we want to do a little, you know, if any listener was possibly a participant in the Pluto burglary underworld removal service or may know such people, we are lighting candles and singing blessings, and if you would return all that is not useful to you, photos, art, backup hard drives, and yes, the drums, her blessed drums with which she does so much good in the world, and we want her heart to be lightened and amazed again for the good of all beings, but also to be my jaunty co-MC at the Symbiosis Gathering. So we have a pitch for you and the magic world, which is to return those things at 2 a.m. tonight, and great blessings and luck will ensue. No questions, no harm, just there we go. It's an Orisha experiment. There we have that. Okay. So it is a confluence of so much right now. As we know, right up, straight up in the sky, you know, we have a waxing moon. It is the full moon on Saturday, August 29th, which is the anniversary, 10th anniversary of Katrina. Obama is in New Orleans right now. Mars in the sky is at 12 degrees Leo. Obama's sun, when he was born, is 12 degrees Leo, S-U-N. Obama is doing good Mars. Good Mars. We might go, no Arctic drilling, but good Mars in New Orleans. He basically translated the Irish saying, God created the potato blight, but it was the British that created the famine. He said, the storm happened, but the government created the tragedy by failing to care for its citizens. And we go, ah, oh, that's so it's true. So we gather at this time. You know, Syria, Remember Me, at such a powerful time, grief and beauty and the healing of loss. And so we do welcome my longtime ally, Deborah Felmuth. I think of her as a Venusian guide to intimacy with the beauty of the Middle East, author of the forthcoming book, Syria, Remember Me. On this waxing moon, Virgo Pisces, the moon of healing and compassionate kinship, the anniversary of Katrina, the time of devastating destruction in Syria, may poignancy and grief strengthen kinship. So welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is a joy for me to hear your voice to know that we were together that day when we came off the river and heard the story of Katrina, and to know that we are once again together in this way on an anniversary that is important and in a time when so much has happened to the Syria, which you visited with me a year before that, actually.
Yes.
And so thank you very much for inviting me in.
Absolutely. And I just, for our listeners and embracing all kin, we were on a 2-week down the river, down the Copper River in Alaska, with our great trickster ally David Grimes as our guide, and we came off the river. Again, 2 weeks of no fossil fuel and no news, and as we got off, the news of Katrina. It's like, oh. And there is this curious interweaving of New Orleans and, you know, and Syria. You had sent me that powerful, sad book, Zaytun, yeah?
Yes. Yes, this is a book that is the story of a Syrian man whose last name is Zaytun, which is also the word for olive. You hear a lot about olives in Syria. In fact, they believe that there's much evidence that's been documented that Syria was the first place in which olive trees were actually cultivated. And so this man of Syrian descent who had come to live in the United States had lived in New Orleans, and his, unfortunately, is a very sad story. Although it's sad, I encourage you to read the book called Zaytun, because he did extraordinarily good work when Katrina hit. And he is, he's really a beautiful example of the heartfelt goodness of Syrians in their most basic and fundamental way. They embody a dignity and a generosity which is extraordinary. And he embodied that in New Orleans, but unfortunately he was treated badly because he was seen as an outsider and he was put in jail. So I don't want to see the spoiler on the story. Right. I encourage you to read it, though, because it's a story about New Orleans, and it's a story about Syria, really.
And it's a story about, you know, the complexity of heart, that people can do terrible things and then they cannot and do wonderful things, like the whoever stole Ami's things, you know, a change of heart throughout mythology and, you know, history and life. We have people doing bad things who have a change of heart, and that's also, you know, part of what we might be appealing to in our radio magic also for Syria. Your beautiful book, we can go anywhere, but it is such a beautiful story of the title, Syria, Remember Me. Do you want to?
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yes, I'm very, very excited that this book is finally coming to press, and hopefully will be out by the 1st of October. It's been a long time coming, and the photographs in it were taken between 1991 and 2011, which is the year that the uprising started in Syria. And the title Remember Me comes from a trip that I was taking on the Euphrates, the great queen of a river, in March of 2002. And I had headed out in my boat with my good friend Esselina, a Dutch woman, we were going around a great curve of river and saw a woman and her two children, a young boy and an older girl, really running helter-skelter down a pretty steep, rocky little bank toward us. And they had done the triangulating, you know, calculations to figure if we run to this point, by the time the boat comes around the river, we'll meet. And we did. And we pulled over right to the side, and the boy held the nose of the boat, which was a great job for him because it was important. And the woman squatted on the riverbank with a very fat hand-rolled cigarette that she was smoking, and her very shy, I'm going to say 13-year-old daughter, was kind of glancing at us and wondering. I could feel her questions, though she did not voice any of them. Her mother did all the talking and said, "Who are you? And where did you come from? And why are you here? And where will you sleep? And what do you eat? And where did you get this boat from? And how come you're wearing those silly-looking vests? And do you love Syria?" And yes, we love Syria very much. And we spoke with her for, I don't know, 20 minutes or half an hour. I asked her questions, too. And how many children do you have, and how far away do you live, and everything else that I could think of to ask. And then it was time to go, and she said, "Okay, ma salame," which is what you say to the person who is leaving. It means go in peace. Mm. "Ma salame," she said. We said, "Hatrak," which means we take your leave. And the boy, second big job, pushed, and off we went. Pretty swiftly right back to the belly of the river. And I turned, even as we were already 20, 30, quickly 40 yards away, and it couldn't have been 40 yards away, but she was tugging on her ring finger as I turned to wave goodbye. And with a swift and very sure motion, she took that ring off, threw it to me, and with great command said, "Zeccherini," which means remember me.
Mm.
And I caught that ring, not because I was so clever in catching it, but because her throw was direct. She went vroom. It went straight into the palm of my hand.
And Vicarini means what again?
It means remember me.
Remember me.
Remember me. And that story, it is behind the title, but it is also the truth about so many, so many, so many people and places that I was privileged enough to be witness to be comrade to be colleague, to be cahoots with.
Yes.
It was 20 years and a little bit more that I spent there discovering nothing but kindness, dignity, hospitality, generosity, simplicity, and a great diversity, terrific tolerance. Syria in the late 20th century was the most secular country in the Middle East, and was very mixed in terms of ethnicities, which it still is. The Kurdish people living up in the northeast, the Ismaili living in the central western portion in the mountains that border Lebanon, the Druze living in the south, the Kurds also living in Damascus, the Turkmen also living in the north. So many, many, many different peoples, ethnic streams, all of them calling themselves Syrian. One of the communities that I admired a lot, the Armenian community. Many, many, many Armenians in Syria, and many of them good musicians, great artists, have in an extraordinary way infiltrated and integrated into Syrian society completely, and yet retained their Armenian identification. They speak Armenian very largely in the home, have Armenian schools, and have Armenian cultural centers. And yet, ask any one of them, what's your nationality? And they're Syrian, very clearly Syrian.
And do you remember the wonderful Armenian caretaker of the church we met late at night wandering through Aleppo? And he took us to his little room?
Yes, that's
yes.
Right.
And I think he had, like, you know, two shirts on a hanger and a bed and his dedication to beauty and his job, and he was so happy to host us, and I think it was where I first heard the fabulous combination of words, because I think you asked him if he was happy, and he said, mazbut mabsut, or something, help me there. but yes, of course happy, you know, in this incredible simplicity and pride. And also that we were walking around Aleppo as women late at night, no problem. I think this is one of the great things that you have guided us to through the radio years, you know, because when I first, before we met, even when I was going to Syria and I knew I was going to meet you, but I was, you know, even progressive lefties were like, oh, Syria, oh. You were such a great guide in so many ways. And I could file scouting reports saying at that time it was one of the safest countries in the world for women, right?
I agree.
It was.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, because when we were going to Dharmarusa and we lost our way, the monastery rebuilt in the cliffs outside Damascus, and we couldn't find it, and you popped into a shop, and the shopkeeper man said, wait, my strong, burly brothers and men friends are coming, we'll close the shop, and you follow us in our car out into the desert, right? And I was like, woo! And you're like, no, it's cool.
Yeah.
And it was.
And it was.
And it was.
I have so many stories on that level where the expectation might be that, wait, we're in danger here. And yet there's a wonderful expression that in Arabic translated means paradise is at the feet of the mother. And what that basically means is that women, being the life givers, the ones who give birth to children, are to be respected more highly than anything else. And therefore, the culture of protection of women is great. Right now, we are sadly, witness to the enslavement of women. And this is neither Islamic nor could be said to be, in any other religion, said to be a possibility of goodness. It is a complete distortion. It's a tragedy. It's a travesty, and it's a danger right now. If I were to go to Syria right now, I would be able to move about somewhat freely in Damascus, but nowhere else. And so the stories that this book tells are both because of the title "Remember Me" is a real story where she shouted out, "Zekarini, remember me," and she wanted literally to be that person. But it also is the idea that Syria needs to be put back together again.
Remembered, yeah.
It needs to be remembered. And so I put these photographs, and the book is largely photographs. It's about 200 color plates and about 30 pages of text about the people of the desert, the people of the Euphrates, about agricultural village life and markets and diversity, a lot about diversity.
And do you have the Baghdad Cafe outside Palmyra?
The Baghdad Cafe isn't actually pictured, but there is a picture of the mountain across from, if you were standing in the Baghdad Cafe, which was a lovely cafe run by a couple of Bedouin brothers who recognized a commercial opportunity. There weren't any road stops on the road from Damascus to Palmyra where you could either have a cup of coffee or use the toilet or anything. And they figured it out. And they built a beautiful little place. And I don't know if they are still there. They may have gone back out into the desert. They may.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, part of our radio magic is there are so many people that you introduced us to and, you know, dear allies Yeah. That we don't know. We don't know their story. But I also want to honor, because everything about Syria, you lived there so long, and I was just honored to be guided by you for a short time, but everything, and it was the man who ran the Baghdad Cafe outside Palmyra, who was, you know, a Bedouin animist, eccentric, and we know that Daesh is not particularly tolerant of eccentrics, because remember he had altars everywhere of fossils he'd found in the deserts, and then, you know, he was like, let's dress you as a Bedouin, right? And then we were pounding coffee and he'd like, well, we're gonna get married and we'll have 1,000 children, but we're a modern marriage, so I'll have the children for you. And he was so witty and wonderful, and you asked him, you know, and it's one of the best, jolliest flirtations I've ever had in my life, really. I have photos to prove it. And it was so radiantly wonderful and funny and witty and profound, and the grinding of the coffee to this particular rhythm. And then you said to him, looking at the magic and kind of pantheism around, mm-hmm. and you said, how did this happen? And he said, Majnun. And which means crazy for the divine, really. I mean, that's absolutely how I've understood it to be, yeah?
Absolutely crazy for the divine.
Crazy for the divine. It was so beautiful. But
so the book is, in a sense, that Syria and Syrians remember themselves. Because I think what has happened now in the tragedy of some real insanity, much of it being imported into the country, not uprising from the Syrian society, but being not only supported by outside elements, but actually brought in from outside, is that fear has caused Syrians themselves to forget and to ward off from each other and wall off from each other in a way that is truly terrifying. And they have good reason. I understand it. But I hope that in some way this book is an offering for them, as well as for those of us in this country or anywhere else in the world who've never been to Syria and go, wow, give me a peek about what did it look like just a couple of years ago. You know, I was speaking to someone in the spring at the Great Mother Conference, curiously enough, another one of our crossing points, and she said to me, I'm so happy you're writing this book. Too often it has happened in my life that I hear about a country only after something terrible has happened, and I want to know, yeah, but what was it like? What did I miss? Because I want to know what it's really like, not what it's like only in its tragic phase. And so,
It joins. There's an amazing book and movie called Image Before My Eyes, and it's just the most exquisite and beautiful compilation of photos and remembrances of the Warsaw Jewish ghetto before the Holocaust, and the movie ends right before, and it is again what you're animating for us too, and our grief for all complexity and beauty that has been so endangered around the world. But it is exquisite, this community of, again, richness and recipes and sharing and old men playing chess and incredible culture. And I want to put before our work table, you know, Matthew Arnold said, to be cultured is to be acquainted with the highest possibilities of the human spirit throughout time. Well, that's a start. You know, I want to include wolves and everything there. Mm-hmm. But we might, you know, we might go to Palmyra now. You know, and in this weaving, you know, you were such a great guide to Syria, as my friend Jessica Radcliffe was such a great guide to New Orleans when I went there pre-Katrina. And she said later, we went to see everything, like you have taken so many people to see so much of Syria. And she said, you know, after Katrina, she said, I don't know why I had such urgency, but I had to take you to see everything. It's as though I could feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, and in your guiding us, Deborah Felmuth, in Syria, we saw so much. You know, and when we arrived at Aleppo, you were like, it's still there. You know, mashallah, may the divine protect it. Mm-hmm. As though there's a feeling of, you know, again, image before our eyes. And again, the importance of richness of goodness of human heart and culture to be remembered.
And to remember also that culture has its roots in the soil, that it really comes from cultivate and that tilling of the soil. So it does include all nature, all creatures.
Right.
And this extraordinary ancient culture, which we find, for instance, in Palmyra, we have evidence of Neolithic habitation there. And we spoke of the olive trees earlier. Palmyra is in the middle of the Syrian desert, but it is at an oasis. And this oasis is a date palm and olive tree oasis. There are also pomegranates there, but it's largely date palms and olives. And the evidence of the cultivation of olives is 6,000 years in that place. And there are springs there. They're called the springs of Ekfa. And this Neba Ekfa. Also, there are documents that relate that these springs were sent through underground water channels called kanat. And these kanat were then basically in a somewhat like a grid fashion, traveled all around the oasis to different portions. And this is a Persian style, actually, so it came from Iran. The water was distributed on 21-day periods so that each section of the oasis would have an equal amount of water to water the trees. They have documentation that this, for hundreds, nay, thousands of years, was the way that the water was distributed here. And I was lucky enough to be able to visit one of the natural springs of Ekfa in the early 90s when I was first there. Unfortunately, in 1998, 99, I'm not positive of the date. It could have been even earlier, 95, 96. A large hotel was built on the edge of the oasis, but an attempt to divert the water from one of the springs to an indoor swimming pool at the hotel caused the spring to go dry.
Symbolic and literal.
Incredible symbolism there. So it was the greed of saying, no, this is going to be for hotel guests, and it was a pretty upscale hotel, blah, 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 had taken a system that for thousands of years had ensured equal rights to water. Another saying in Arabic is, وَجَعَلْنَا مَنَ الْمَاءِ كُلُّ شَيْءٍ حَيٍّ, which is everything living comes from the water. And so their reverence for water and their acknowledgement that our culture includes cultivation and that we share equally in this and that we are not. They were really exhibiting the understanding that we are stewards of the earth and not lords over all of the earth.
And do you remember in Aleppo when we were guided to the heart of the souk, and our friend told us this was the earliest mental health hospital 2,500 years ago, which is how long that souk has been operating until now.
Yeah.
And people were healed by the sound of running water.
Yes, sound of running water. So there was always a fountain. Many of these places in Aleppo and in Damascus, you can still see it the best. There are the Arabic style means that the exterior is a wall that is pretty impenetrable looking. You don't get much information. Most likely stone. In Aleppo, surely stone. And in Damascus, some combination of stone or wattle and daub with wood foundations. And then this is called the architecture of the veil. Really, because outside you don't see anything. There are no outward facing windows. If you are invited in, you go down the hallway and you end up in a large courtyard. And in the courtyard, you realize everything is revealed. You can see all of the rooms of the house on the bottom level, with a garden in the center, with a fountain, with trees, with lemon, with jasmine, with roses.
So we're going to take a very short musical break right now.
Okay.
And then we will enter the courtyard of our radio show. And just tying, I'm wearing a necklace from New Orleans and the address that you got me in for Syria. All of these syncretisms. So we're going to play just a little bit of this very profound song, Waterbound, written for New Orleans, performed by my neighbors and friends Lilt, Tina Eck, and Keith Carr. And here's just a little smidge of this. So again, you know, grief unites us all. So here's that beautiful song.
Thank you.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our wonderful guest, Deborah Felmuth, is guiding us to the beauty, the loss, and the remembering of Syria. And that was a wonderful song, Waterbound, performed by my friends and neighbors, Lilt, Tina Eck, and Keith Carr. It's all gone, and it won't be back. Say my name and don't forget, you know, very powerful, this song of loss, grief, and beauty. And that is part of our theme. And just as a radio magic to heal micro and macro loss, as I mentioned, Michaela Gaston and I will be emceeing at the Symbiosis Gathering, symbiosisgathering.com, September 17th through 20th in Oakdale, California. And it was her, Ami's studio and office in Oakland last Friday at 6 p.m. that was really efficiently burgled, everything, the Pluto Removal Service, drums, photos, pictures from Kajiristan, all around the world, all the goodness that she's been doing. She is one of the most beautiful and radiant, charismatic black women singers, magical people I know. So we're just saying, you know, if you were involved, a participant in the Pluto Underworld Removal Service, or might know such people, Venus is emerging from the underworld now. We're on a change of heart tour, you know. You might have burgled, but you can be heroes now. Heroes now. We're just inviting, you know, not expecting. That leads to disappointment, but willing, you know, for those things that are not useful, not treasures to you or to somebody you might know. And drums. She needs her drums so that we can perform together, you know, and at Symbiosis. You know, just to return them at 2 a.m. tonight to the studio office in Oakland from which you were. Anyway, that's our little bit of magic over there. All right, now back again, Deborah Felmuth, our great ally, and we were just entering into the courtyard, but I want also, part of what catalyzed our conversation is, the ongoing and recent destruction in Palmyra, and you had reminded me it wasn't the big temple of Baal, it was the small temple, that was.
No. It was the smaller temple of Belshamin. One of the beautiful things of Syria, and evident very clearly in Palmyra, is this extraordinary mixture of religions. You can see earlier cultures, you know, having reverence for Astarte. You can still see that. Ishtar. You can see everything associated with the planet Venus.
Right.
Baal Hadad, the storm and thunder god, Anat, the warrior queen. And all of these are evident. And in Palmyra especially, you have Aglibol and Yarhibol associated with the moon and the sun. So when you have Bel Shamin, you have Bel, which is also sometimes Baal Hadad. Bel and Baal Hadad are the same. Bel Shamin is also the light behind the sun. So it is the supreme god, call it that. And this is a very small temple that was in a relatively intact state. I do not know how greatly it has been damaged. It could be completely damaged. It was built with some pretty enormous blocks, and I mean enormous. A block of stone taller than you or I, and several feet thick. It wasn't open. There was a gate across, and you could look into the center of this small temple from the exterior, and inside that temple there was a fig tree, and that fig tree was usually host to a lot of birds, which always gave this very small temple of Bel Shamin a completely magical and beautiful look and sound.
Because when I first sent you the New York Times article, and I was like, oh no, because they said the Temple of Baal, no, the blowing up of Bel Shamin. Yeah, the big one. And Bel Shamin, again, poignant, and it looks pretty gone. It looks pretty gone. Huge detonations. We have a picture of it. But the Temple of Baal, I mean, again, part of what the poignancy, and it's still there. Oh, okay, so you say mashallah, yes?
Mashallah, yes.
Mashallah. Thank you. Thank Mashallah.
God protect this.
Oh, my God. Because remember, our guide had said this is how this temple protected itself from humans, because all representations of the divine were present for 2,000 years, and this is how it kept itself physically safe, because it had brass bolts surrounded by lead through the structure of the building, so in an earthquake, the lead would become liquid and the brass bolts would hold it together, and people from Japan and all over would come study this incredibly ingenious 2,000-year-old protection from earthquake technology.
Incredibly.
So that's still there, all right?
That is still there. In the first century A.D., some say, and I don't know the veracity of this, some say it was the largest temple in the world in the first century. So at this time, you had streams. The Palmyrians themselves are descendants of the Amorites, the Aramaeans, and the tribes of northern Arabia. So these three ethnic streams became the Palmyrians. And inside this, you also had Jewish culture, Christian culture. You had a very, very strong pagan culture. All of these gods that had to do with the planets. Do you remember inside the Temple of Baal, there was an inner sanctum where the roof had the zodiac entirely carved in it on the ceiling. And this is blackened by many, many fires, because that turned out to be a very, very good place to be sheltered, as the rest of the temple is relatively wide open. So it had many fires, and I'm sure hosted many, many people sleeping, because the actual ruins, and especially the temple, were used for people to live up until the 1930s. And it was the French who said, wait a second, you can't live in this. This is an archaeological site. And that is when the modern town of Palmyra was built.
Uh-huh.
So the little town to the side where you and I went and we had our meals, and where we went to the market, and where we, you know, walked up and down the streets, didn't really exist until the 30s.
And there was, again, the Bedouin shopkeeper who offered my father 100 camels for my hand in marriage.
That's true.
And you said that was a pretty good deal.
Camels are expensive.
Right, well,
they thought, wow.
So camels are, what, about $10,000 each?
I have no idea.
Anyway, you told me at the time. But that was also a splendid to and fro. And also, remember when he also was like, let's dress you as a Bedouin. And you did say, you do look like a Bedouin, but your face is soft. And he said, I think it was Saeed, I can't remember his name, maybe Saeed, but he said, I tell you what, you get up at dawn, walk until dusk, and soon you'll have the complete look. So very charming, very charming. Yeah. But also, there is, we do want to honor someone, you know, the head of antiquities who just gave his life to protect the treasure of Syria. Can you say
Khalid,
a bit about him?
Khalid al-Assad is
83. He was
83 years old. Was the epitome, really, of the dignity of a Syrian man. He dedicated his life. He was Palmyran, born and bred there, raised there, went to Damascus University, and then moved back and became the director of antiquities at the Palmyra Museum, which is a really extraordinary place. He had retired from there. His sons do still work at the museum, and he was a generous soul and very dedicated to what he knew in his bones, but what he reached out to the Danish and the Japanese in particular have done a great deal of work in the archaeological sector in Palmyra. So he reached out to these communities and said, help us to understand this treasure which we need to steward. And for that, he just needs to be given all praise, because there are many people who try to go, mine, mine, stay away. And he did the exact opposite. He, and with the help of the Syrian government, got a good deal at excavation, and yet there's at least another 80 acres of Palmyra that is still to be excavated.
But he lost his life because he would not tell Daesh where the treasures were hidden.
Yeah. When the Islamic State marched into Palmyra about 3 months ago, he refused to leave. And he had already, long before this point, taken all of the material of the priceless material of the museum. And the state has done this also in the Damascus Museum, also in the Aleppo Museum, many museums, and have hidden them. I don't know where. I have no idea.
No, no, it's best for no one to know.
Well
maybe
know.
One or two people who survived to know, yes.
Oh, I don't know what they would do, because there's a lot. There was everything from, one of my favorite cases was the case that had the flints that came out of a cave in Palmyra that were Neolithic. I looked at these stone tools and said, oh my God, we've been trying to, you know, figure this out for a long time. We've been living here for a long, long time. God protect this, mashallah. All the way up to some of the carvings that used to be on the front of tombstones that had been put into the museum. Beautiful. The women either carrying a spindle, a drop spindle, or an olive branch, and very often a child, and wearing, you could see how exquisitely decorated these Palmyran women were. Beautiful earrings, beautiful necklaces. I'm sure that he was instrumental in having all of this moved. He may not even know where it was moved to, but he was certainly not going to tell if he did, and he lost his life.
And yes, he was beheaded by Daesh, and his head on a stake. And we send him all reverence and homage. And before we leave Palmyra and do a little journey to Aleppo, you know, that we remember in, again, Palmyra, you guided us so well, and our guides, there were guides of guides, that it was brought to its fullness on the Silk Route by Queen Zenobia. And I love our guide saying, yes, her husband died mysteriously, but I'm sure Zenobia had nothing to do with it. Not my Zenobia. Very intimate, very intimate. And also, we loved her because she moved the place of receiving in state to the bathhouses, where there was warm baths and medium baths and cool baths. And we go, must have been a Libran. That's fabulous. And that she would gallop bareback into the desert. And then, yes, again, she provoked the Romans one too many times, and they did haul her off. But an extraordinary person.
Well, she really vied for control of that region with the Romans, and lasted a long time.
And related to Cleopatra, right? A grandniece or something?
I don't know about that relation, to be honest with you. It's possible, but I just don't know.
And,
But I do know, you know, that her her vying with the Romans for control of that region, because that's the furthest east that the Romans penetrated. And, you know, what we see in Palmyra is of Roman era, because the Romans left colossal, colossal buildings and temples and columns and, you know, you can say, wow, is that really what we want to look at here? I prefer to look deeper than that.
It's harder to find.
Because you have to be with a trained archaeologist to begin to notice, because the culture there is older, deeper, more native, more natural, and more polytheistic.
Right.
And
And part of what we want to bring alive again, that we honor again, is as things are destroyed, like when the Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed, we say, okay, what terrible grief, but may the dedicated beauty inside them spiral into the world. And remember in Palmyra, they're brought to its height, by Queen Zenobia, but there were signs everywhere going, and if you're going back to Tibet, follow this star and turn right over here, and if you're going back to Africa, do that. There were signposts everywhere of this quality of, the syncretism, the positive merging of cultures that we want, and we might even just say in a big way, the unifying story of the earth dissolves false boundaries of self and other and nation state and all. But
say that again, false boundaries.
Yes,
this is the truth. And when I dive in, not only to the subject of Syria and certainly not only to my book, but to the subject of humanity, I want to say we are one, and this is happening to us here. Zealotry in all of its forms needs to be warded off, and we are at our peril if we do not take that seriously.
Well, And I also, tying to many past shows, it is any profound story like what you guide us to in Syria will take us to all stories. The destruction of culture and cultural artifacts, the Spanish to the Aztec and the Maya, the Spanish to the indigenous California civilization that we've done several shows on, and Pope Francis, it's not too late to change your mind about canonizing Junipero Serra on the autumnal equinox because he was an inquisitor. So the massive destruction of libraries and art and temples, the death squads in Bali, the British almost blew up the Taj Mahal, right? They were setting the dynamite, and then somebody had a change of heart going, maybe not. But they almost did that. So this brutishness is a toxic default of our species, but it's also, the destruction of culture. But then, as you're doing in your dedication and so many beautiful Syrians and everywhere where culture's been destroyed, to remember and keep it alive, going, no. So the powerful imagery remains inspiring.
But I do want to give you, the dedication or the frontispiece in the book is a quote from a Lebanese author by the name of Amin Malouf.
Famous person.
Yeah, I was just struck by this sentence and said, this is really the point. He says, if we are to restore some hope to our disoriented humanity, we must go beyond a mere dialogue of cultures and beliefs toward a dialogue of souls. And that's really the truth. It is a dialogue of souls. When we say the word soul, there's a wonderful correlation in Arabic. We have it in many cultures with breath. So we have the word ruh. And this is, even the sound of it is like breath. You can try and say it, ruh, ruh, and you feel that that comes at the end of it. And so this dialogue of souls is a very important quality to remember, that when we talk souls, it can be the souls of the trees. I remember when you and I did a program right on this station a couple of years ago when Yosemite was burning.
Yes, yes.
It was the 2,000-year-old redwoods that were in danger, but it was a prayer of 2,000 years ago in Syria that is a prayer for rain that we used. This is the kind of dialogue of souls where we realize that we are one. We are one.
With the world in conflagration. Let's just have a smidge of the Aleppo music that you sent so that we can journey there with the world in conflagration, so that we can journey to the heart of that souk and remember it, where the waters and the springs were healing
this
human hearts.
This is a man by the name of Sabri Mudallal.
Excellent. Here we go. You were saying you were introducing him. There we go. Do you want to, again?
It's an old song. And this was, I believe, a 2012 recording. I believe that he has died of old age, not of any horrible...
He's dancing. In the YouTube, he's dancing.
In that one? Oh, that's great.
It's really great, yes.
It's a song about memory. There's a great acknowledgement that memory is an important connective tissue, let's call it, of the world, and that we need to tell the stories, we need to sing the songs, we need to dance the dances that actually physicalize the memory of who we are, where we have been, what we have done. And so Aleppo, again, one of the oldest cities in the world, they say that Damascus is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, but we also know that the great mound of Aleppo has Abrahamic stories associated with it. They say that Abraham, was coming south from his home in Urfa, which is in present-day Turkey.
I might go there. Okay.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yes.
Moving south, came through the region of Aleppo. And that he was, they even say that the milking of his goats is what gives rise to the name of Aleppo, which in Arabic is called Halab, which also is related to the word Halib, which is milk.
Okay.
So, this ancient town with its incredible stone buildings, because it is in the north of Syria, a great stone massif area where all the what are called the dead cities of Syria, cities that were abandoned in the 7th century, but Byzantine architecture. So Aleppo has an enormous wealth and largely underground of centuries and centuries
And it was, we only have a few moments left here, but it was, am I wrong that it was the oldest continuous souk in the world until now? Is that not right?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. It's quite possible. The stone souk of Aleppo were burned by the rebels in 2013.
Right.
And it is not the first time that they have been burned. So I hold out hope for them. I know that a great deal of Aleppo has been damaged beyond repair. The stone minaret of the mosque, the great Umayyad mosque of Aleppo, is gone. That was
So, sweetie, we're on our way out, but might you have a short prayer that we can waft out on?
Actually, I have my prayer is that because we have such a great, long, and beautiful history to look back on in Syria, that we may have just such a great, long future to look forward to, that this is a very bad patch and that we will get through it.
Excellent.
This too.
And any blessing briefly in Arabic?
In Arabic. Inshallah bil khair, inshallah bi salam, inshallah ya latif, Allah kareem, inshallah bil khair.
Thank you so much, Deborah Felmuth. We will let everyone know when your book comes out. And thanks always to Alex Drewinskis and Gaston in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Thanks again, Deborah Felmuth.
This is Philip Muldery, host of The Sunday Show. Join me and my guests every Sunday morning, 9 to 11. We'll be talking about politics. We'll be talking about the state of things around us. Plus, we open the phones to your called-in questions and comments. That's every Sunday morning, The Sunday Show, on community-powered KPFA.
Hello there. I'm Quincy McCoy, General Manager of KPFA, inviting you to join us Thursday, October 22nd, when New York Times bestselling author David Talbot discusses his jolting new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot is the founder and former CEO of Salon.com and the author of bestsellers Brothers and The Seasons of the Witch. I look forward to talking with David about the rise of America's secret government at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, 2345 Channing Way. There is wheelchair access at this important KPFA event. Advance tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com and supportive independent bookstores, or you can find out more information at kpfa.org. For David Talbot, live, October 22nd.